welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Once upon a time, libraries were a place for books. But times change, and libraries have had to work to keep up with what patrons need and want. Today, people go to libraries for access to computers, the internet, digital books, and music, and more. You can rent DVDs at the library as well, but many of us have now become accustomed to watching videos on websites like Netflix and Hulu, or we can get it on demand if we have premium television. So many other options. To keep up with the times, Columbus Metropolitan Library recently announced the launch of a new program to permit people to rent video and audio content online. Here to tell us more is Robin Nesbitt. She is the Director of Collection Management at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. Welcome to the show, Robin.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Ann. It's great to be here.
It's called Hoopla.
Right.
Who came up with the name and what does it do?
I assume that a marketing whiz at the company Midwest came up with the name, although I do like it. It's kind of fun to say having some hoopla. Mm-hmm. Midwest is a company here in Ohio, which is kind of cool. We're supporting, you know, an Ohio business. They're in Holland, which for folks who don't know is actually a suburb of Toledo. And they have been working on this product for a while. In fact, we have a vendor relationship, you know, a sales rep, and I kept telling her, said, you need to get into the streaming business. Libraries need to be in this world. They're a trusted vendor. They do really good things with their products. And so they've been working on this for the last year. But how they came up with Hoopla, I don't know.
So how does it work? Do you have to be a library card holder?
Yeah, okay. You need to have a library card with the Columbus Metropolitan Library, and you can do that online at our website, columbuslibrary.org, or go into any of our branches or main library and get a card. Right now, Hoopla is in what we're calling its beta phase. So really, we're only one of seven libraries in the country that have it. So Midwest hasn't fully launched the product yet. I believe they're having the soft launch in June or July. So the really great thing is that Columbus and Columbus cardholders get to help fashion this product. And so as they use it, they give us feedback. And actually, I think there's a survey now out on our website asking users, hey, what do you think about this? So that the product can get even better. So pretty cool.
Why was something like this needed? Why did you think it was the right trajectory?
Well, that's a great question because a lot of people still think of libraries as books. And as we know, books are changing into ebooks. Media is the same way. Obviously, a lot of us use iTunes. We stream stuff through Netflix and Hulu. And I really think it's important for public libraries to stay relevant in this digital age. It's not to say that we're getting rid of our hard copy. We had a lot of questions from our staff about, oh my goodness, are you going to get rid of DVDs and music CDs and audiobooks on CD? And we're not doing that. We're keeping those formats. But we want to dip our toe into this streaming world. We want to stay relevant to those customers of the library who want to experience streaming media. So that's why we decided to go down this path.
What were the biggest hurdles in the technology like this? Did the company that created Hoopla, are they the ones working through this for you?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, basically all the technology resides on their servers. It's really out in the cloud, though, and they purposely, when they designed this product, I think part of the reason of going behind some other big library digital companies is they were able to see what didn't work very well. So, for example, right now the library has OverDrive, which provides ebooks and audiobooks. And admittedly, it's a little cumbersome to use. It's not as smooth as, say, an Amazon experience. There's also the Zinio product, which we recently launched, which is digital magazines, even easier to use. Hoopla is probably the easiest of all three products that we provide to use. And I think it's because that company really looked at how consumers are using technology and really wanted to mimic, for lack of a better term, the Apple experience. I have an iPad, I have an iPhone, I see that content, boom, I get that content. And so I think that that company was, they deliberately developed it for mobile devices. It does work on a PC, but they really set out first and foremost to make this work on tablets, on iPhones, Android devices as well. So that's the part I really like, is it's very easy to get people up and running on the product.
Okay, you already answered my next question. What devices are compatible?
Yeah.
What features make it different than what people might expect? Just the ease of clicking into it?
Or? I think the ease of use is one thing. The other thing that's cool with Hoopla, unlike some of our other library products, is what it's kind of called, what I like to use the term, max access. So you and I can both get the same album or the same movie or the same book on CD. I don't have to wait for you to get done with it. So that's pretty nice. The library pays on the back end. I mean, there's no cost, obviously, to the cardholder, but the library pays on the back end per checkout. So if you check out the item and then I check out the item, the library gets charged for each checkout, basically. So that's, I really like that because I don't have to worry about holds lists. So I don't have to worry about, oh my goodness, I only have two copies. And now all of a sudden I have 80 people waiting for it and I got to buy more. All 80 of those folks can check out the same thing at the same time. So,
well, how much does that cost the library? The same for every person? Or?
Well, it's not based on person. It's based on the format. Okay. So it can range anywhere from 99 cents to $2.99, depending on albums. I would say are averaging around $1.29. And keep in mind, it's an album, not just a song. You know, in the iPhone world or in the iTunes world, you're paying $1.29 for a song. In the library world, I let you check out a whole album and it's only costing the library that much money. Audiobooks are a little bit more because they are longer. There's more work involved in producing an audiobook on CD. I would say in the movies, it depends on the... And keep in mind, too, most of this pricing is set by Midwest, what they negotiated with the companies. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the work that Midwest is doing is convincing these companies, hey, this is a great way to get your product out there to the library world. We want to be fair about it. We want to pay. We don't want to, you know, burn things or be free or whatever. So it's Midwest negotiating on behalf of libraries and trying to convince companies, hey, this is a great way to get your information out there, your product out there. So
you have one. You have an album. You have one album. 80 people want to listen to the album.
Right.
You pay the owner of the album for owner of the music or whatever.
Right.
Something per use, something per borrow.
Exactly.
And then how does the library afford to do that? Is this from your book budget or what?
Well, no, we purposely set out this year. We have a digital content budget now. Mm-hmm. As you can imagine, since we're buying, you know, ebooks and all this other content, we've budgeted a certain portion of the budget, probably around 10% of the budget or so is digital content. The nice thing about this product is that we can meter it on the back end. So essentially right now, as a library card holder, you can get 6 downloads per month. And then we also can cap it at a dollar range because libraries need to manage their money over 12 months. So I can't just put this product out here and then in 30 days go, oops, sorry, can't use it anymore because we've run out of money.
So you limit how many times
That's
someone
right.
can use it.
That's right. But it's true of our hard copy. I limit you on how many books you can check out.
Right.
Again, it's metered access so that there's material around for everybody to use. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Robin Nesbitt. She's Director of Collection Management at Columbus Metropolitan Library. We're talking about a new program there that allows people to rent video and audio content online. It's called Hoopla. If you have a question or comment for Robin, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, and quicker yet, go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Has your digital budget grown a lot in recent years? Everything's happening very, very fast.
Yes, it has. We used to budget, I'd say, around $30,000, and now we're closer to $1 million. And to be honest, though, that's still a small percentage. I want to reassure all the bookworms out there that our book budget is still the biggest portion of the pie. I mean, I'm an avid book reader. I love books dearly. It's still the biggest portion of the pie. However, there is, as a public library, being good stewards and paying attention to trends and wanting to stay relevant, a certain portion of our dollars are now going to digital.
Does $1 million for digital get you more in content than it would in hardcover books?
No, it doesn't.
Interesting.
This is where I get cranky, and I want everybody else to get cranky. Our director, Pat Lazinski, is doing a great job working with legislatures at the state and federal level. But what a lot of people don't realize is for ebook content, I'll pay, for example, Gone Girl. The library will pay $75 for an ebook of Gone Girl. You could go on to Amazon and pay $12.99. Again, it's the publishers controlling price. It's the publishers controlling content because they don't really understand the library market and what we're trying to do. So it's my dollars don't go as far in the digital world, at least with ebooks, for sure.
Since the launch, how has it been now?
We launched March 1st.
So it's only been a few weeks.
Right.
What kind of feedback have you received so far, or what kind of use?
It's amazing. I haven't had any feedback. And part of me thinks no news is good news, for one thing, mm-hmm. because if the technology wasn't working, I'm pretty sure I'd hear about it. Staff at minimum. But customer comments, haven't had too much. I looked at numbers the other day, and we were around 2,200, 2,500 people had signed up within the last 3 weeks, which mm-hmm. I think is phenomenal. And checkouts were around that, about the same amount, 2,000 to 2,200. So people are at least going out and exploring. I will admit right now that the content, I've been telling people, it's kind of so-so because the company's still working on nailing down even better content.
Mm-hmm.
I will say if you're a book on CD listener, it's great. I popped one onto my iPod or my iPhone and then plugged it into my car and then boom, there I had a whole book to listen to. So,
yeah, I think that's where I'm going to be getting involved with it
quickly. And music, I think, is probably over 200,000 album titles. So there's a lot of music out there. I need to explore that. I haven't gotten to that point yet.
And this means you can borrow 6 albums a month, or
yep.
3 books and 3 albums, or 3 books on CD, or
yep.
or whatever. It's 6 total a month
for now. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
For now,
yeah.
And then when I go onto the website, you have to sign up for it.
Sure.
And then the actual function of it is like you compared it to iTunes
yep.
or something like that. It's that simple.
There's a Hoopla app out there on the App Store, so you
okay.
can go through.
You got to get the Hoopla app.
To use it on your
okay.
iPad or your iPhone. Also,
okay.
there's an Android app, so you can sign up online or you can do it all through the app.
Okay.
Yeah, so either way. They tried to make it so that if you had just a mobile experience, you can do it that way. You never have to touch a PC. So, yeah, and the Hoopla app is free. I've got it on both my iPad and my iPhone.
How long have you been in the library business?
Oh, I need 24 years.
So what do you expect 24 years from now? What do you think it's going to look like?
I know. I had this conversation not too long ago with somebody. And I said, first of all, I don't think books are going anywhere. I think it's going to take a generation at least before books are a smaller niche than they are. Until everybody is raised on tablets, and that's how you read, and that's how you learn, and that's how your whole experience. Right now, we're still a print-based culture, So as far as libraries, we're still going to be in that book business. The way we loan things, I think, will change. I think that the fact that I can sit on my couch at 10 o'clock at night, and I have a panoply of choices. Now, granted, I have the wherewithal to afford that, and I have the machines, but those prices are dropping, too. So I do think that libraries, and we're certainly trying to do this, are looking more at how can we help with reading. Maybe it's not about the container so much as making people able to read, so helping with kids. Homework help, I think, so services is probably going to be a leading edge for libraries, and our lending edge that role may change a little bit.
But some people, too, go to the library as a curator.
Sure. That's a good point.
You're telling me what's good to read.
That's a good point. And I think that's where we also have been pushing what we call reader's advisory in the library world. Basically, we don't care how you read. We want you to read. And if you're looking for good stuff, come in and find us. So you just read The New Gone Girl. How about this new ton of French mystery, Broken Harbor? Have you tried that yet? And a lot of times when I am in the branches, when I'm helping folks trying to find things to read, I said, hey, take 5 or 6. They're free. If you don't like them, bring them back. Don't worry about it. So it's encouraging people to try things and not be afraid of, because I understand if you're not an avid reader like I am, a whole wall of books is just intimidating. And so the library staff's there to help you go, let's find some good stuff and take these. And if you don't like them, come back. We'll find something else.
Even with all the cuts and stuff, you guys still have time to help out like that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Ohio is very fortunate. We've got great funding here locally. Columbus Metropolitan's well supported. And so, yeah, I mean, that really is our focus, is customer service and folks walking through the door. Our new mantra is don't let anybody leave with their hands empty, man. We want people reading and enjoying our great stuff. So, yeah, it's pretty cool.
All right. Well, Robin Nesbitt, thanks for joining us today to tell us about it.
Happy to be here. Thanks, Ann.
Robin Nesbitt is the Director of Collection Management at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. Coming up, birding optics and gear. What's new? What's the latest? We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The homeless population in L.A. has always been concentrated on Skid Row, but now that developers want a piece of that street, dynamics are changing.
Things really changed a lot when the interest in downtown and especially in the Skid Row area picked up, and now there's huge amounts of development and there's huge amounts of pressure.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, gentrifying the homeless, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace this evening at 6 on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. Thanks for joining us. It's 30 degrees with partly sunny skies today and a high near 38. Clear skies tonight, a low of 24. Increasing clouds on Wednesday, a high of 35. Clouds Wednesday night, a low of 19. Support comes from Assisted Technology of Ohio. AT Ohio is now accepting donations of used computers to be refurbished and made available to Ohioans with disabilities. AT Ohio offers a variety of disability programs and services, including a device loan library. Donation information is at atohio.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The spring migration begins next month. Now is the time to get prepared technologically. And like most hobbies these days, there's an important technological element to getting the most from your bird watching. This weekend, birders will be flocking to the Birding Optics and Gear Expo at the Grange Insurance Audubon Center, just south of downtown Columbus. You can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information about the expo. Joining us now to talk about it is Bill Thompson III. He's the editor and co-publisher of Birdwatchers Digest and a chief organizer of the expo. Welcome back to the show, Bill.
Thanks a lot, Ann. Good to be here as always.
Why an expo? Besides just visiting the beautiful Audubon Center, why did it occur to you that a birding optics and gear expo is something important at this point?
Well, you know, back when I started as a bird watcher, you couldn't just walk into any store and buy even bird feeders, much less binoculars and field guides. And these days, a lot of things we buy on the internet, it's easy to do. You know, you buy a book, you know what it's going to be, basically. But optics, they're a little bit more expensive proposition, and it's a highly personal thing. I mean, not every binocular or spotting scope is right for every person. And for bird watching, that's a pretty important tool for any kind of outdoor nature watching. The optics are very important, and it's really, really great to be able to test in your hand binocular after binocular until you find the one. It's like Cinderella's slipper. You know, there's one out there that's perfect for you. And so we had the idea with our friends from Eagle Optics to try to put this together so that our Ohio birding community and, you know, nature community, hunters, outdoor people could come in and just get a chance to put their hands on all these amazing new optics.
And what a great venue. The Grange Insurance Audubon Center is on board as well, not only the venue, but part of it, right?
That's right. Yeah, they have been our gracious hosts for this, and we're really looking forward to it because that if you've never been to the Grange Insurance Audubon Center, it's a LEED certified building. It's beautiful. It's built in a very green fashion. It's got an incredible view out over a restored wetland marsh habitat, and right beyond that is the skyline of Columbus. So lots of great things to for people to come and look at when they're testing these optics. And we're going to have a lot of gear there, too. We've got a couple local Columbus businesses that are well-known coming in, the Midwest Photo Exchange and Clintonville Outfitters are both going to be there selling their wares. So should be pretty fun.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Thompson III, editor and co-publisher of Birdwatchers Digest. If you have a question or comment about the gear, optics, and gear and so forth for bird watching, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Chris in Clintonville, you're on the air with Bill Thompson. Welcome.
Good morning. I have a particular challenge in that I'm a low-vision person. I'm borderline legally blind. I see well enough to walk around without a cane or dog, but I like to go birding with my girlfriend, but traditionally I only benefit from a monocular telescope because one of my eyes is not good enough, and I also wear glasses. So what I'm looking for is a monocular telescope that one can use with the glasses where the refraction point is at a point where you can get a wide enough angle when you have your glasses on and still, you know, get a good field of view when you're looking up at a tree to find an animal.
Right. Well, a couple of suggestions that could work. First of all, there are a couple of new monoculars on the market that are small enough to handhold, so it's basically like half of a binocular.
Yeah, that's what I'm used to. I use those frequently, but they're right, not wide enough field.
Yeah, there's a new one from Leica that's really nice, and I know Minox has a new one out. And both those companies will be there at the expo. The other thing is there are lots and lots of these new little travel scopes that are coming into the market that are lightweight, really portable, and you can use them with a monopod. So I know some hawk watchers and people who are gazing at long distances for birds are using those now. And pretty much every optical device that's being sold to outdoor people, bird watchers and so forth, they all take into consideration the eye relief for people, for those of us who wear eyeglasses. And I know back when I started, it was those hard plastic or metal eye cups that you couldn't put down. It was like looking through a pipe, you know, from a great distance. But now pretty much all the eyepieces rotate down or fold down or something so that you can get right up close so you get a full field of view. So I would definitely recommend coming in and trying these things out and asking lots of questions, because there'll be probably at least a dozen different optics companies with their products represented there.
Thank you, Chris, for that call. Chris is a really good example of why someone should, you know, why the struggle, if you have a particular issue, you know, it would be scary to just order something online or just go with what one or two examples in the store.
Yeah, and, you know, there are a lot of stores that are that do sell binoculars. Not all of them have a wide range, but the difference here is these are people who have been outfitting folks for outdoor use with optics professionally for years. So this is it's like your chance to get a really good consultation on what's the right one for you.
You know, a lot has changed in terms of the optics of scopes, mm-hmm. for scopes or binoculars. Would an expensive pair from 30 years ago that, you know, assuming it's not, the lens isn't cracked like mine mm-hmm. or whatever, hold up today?
Well, you know, of course, really good optics tend to stay really good for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, time and age and weather and treating them badly will do things to degrade the image. But the funny thing is, and the $1,000 binocular of 1985 would, you can buy optical quality for a couple of $100 now because of the advances. They would have been a lot heavier because they would have been real leaded glass in there. Now we're using all kinds of coatings and things that transmit a lot more light. So the technology has really put us into the golden age of birding now when it comes to optics. And the lightweight materials that they're made out of, you know, incredibly waterproof and airtight, nitrogen purged, coated lenses inside and out. It really makes for a device that's almost like, you know, a luxury item, but pretty affordably priced. I mean, you can get into a really nice pair of binoculars for $250, $300, and you're buying quality that 10 or 15 years ago would have cost you three times that amount.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Bill Thompson III. He's editor and co-publisher of Birdwatchers Digest. We're talking about gear, optical gear, and other kinds of bird-watching gear. If you have a question or comment for Bill, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page. You know, when I was birding with you guys briefly last spring, mm-hmm. I think your spouse, Julie Zicafus, the great naturalist and artist and so forth, and the author gave me, or loaned me briefly, her camera to look
right
through, because her camera was so fantastic. And she said this camera was so great for birding. Are there cameras that are better for birding than others, better for the birding?
Yeah, and that, boy, I'll tell you, that's a question we could talk about for hours, because the changes in cameras have been even more astounding than the changes in just about anything else. You can now, if you have the money, walk into a camera store like Midwest Photo Exchange, and you can plop down, oh, you know, $3,000, $4,000 if you have that kind of money, and you can get a camera that can take a picture in the your backyard that could be on the cover of National Geographic tomorrow, because that's how much technology is now packed into these cameras. Funny thing is, you can also get a camera for a couple of $100 that you can hold up to your binoculars or your spotting scope, or you can even do it with your iPhone or your smartphone now. Hold it up with a little adapter to your spotting scope and take a picture that is unbelievable in quality. I've been looking at hundreds of thousands of pictures in my 30 years here at Birdwatchers Digest.
Mm-hmm.
The quality of pictures that the average person can take with their phone, with their point-and-shoot camera, it boggles the mind, the quality, because we've packed all this technology into these tiny little devices. So a huge trend among birdwatchers now is what we call phone scoping, where they're taking an adapter, putting their smartphone in it, holding it up to their binoculars or their spotting scope, and taking full-frame, beautiful pictures that would rival, a digital SLR camera from today. So it's very, very powerful. And the neat thing, if you're taking them on your phone, is you can put them right up on Twitter, Facebook, on the All Sides website. You can put the pictures up right now.
Besides optics, what are the kind of gear is out there that birders are excited about?
Well, back about 15 years ago, a thing called the bino harness came on the market, which is kind of holds your binoculars in this X strap across your shoulders and keeps them from bouncing around and swaying. It's very comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. You know, birders are always looking for hats and birding vests to carry all their stuff. I'm a real advocate of having a waist pack that you can put your camera in, or I don't so much like the vest thing. I don't like having anything else hanging on my shoulder, but having a waist pack where you can keep your phone and your camera or your adapters or anything, that's really handy. And of course, you got to have, when you're transporting all this gear, you've got to have a big camera bag or an optics bag. I know when I fly, I take a big padded bag with me for my camera and my spotting scope and my binoculars. And I've never had an optical fatality in all my travels, even though I've watched my bags get tossed, you know, hither and yon. So those are the kinds of things. The other thing that is really a big trend with birdwatchers is getting apps on their phones for bird songs, for bird finding, for keeping lists and records of your birds. And, you know, again, when we first started having smartphones and apps, there were one or two that were really great and out there a lot of people used. Now there are at least, I'd say, two dozen really nice birding apps. Some of them are field guides to help you identify. Some of them are just sound guides. Some even quiz you on bird sounds. And that's a great thing as we get near spring migration, is to pull out your smartphone or your iPad or your Kindle and test yourself on bird calls. Get your ears ready for spring.
614-292-8513. If you have a question or comment for Bill Thompson, editor and co-publisher of Birdwatchers Digest, get the question in soon. We have still have a few more minutes. You mentioned that, you know, people can shoot something with a camera with different apps and so forth that'll rival anything in National Geographic. Any concerns in the business, and given what you do as publisher of Birdwatchers Digest, about photographs being tweaked?
Well, you know, it's a philosophical question.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell more or less when photos are tweaked. Now, just about every photographer out there, professional or otherwise, is doing, you know, upping the contrast, cropping out a leaf that's annoying in the corner of the picture. They're brightening, they're sharpening, all that stuff's happening. I sort of equate that to going and getting a haircut,
mm-hmm.
you know, at the barbershop. It's just making the photo look a little bit better. When you're talking about photoshopping parts onto birds or things like that you know, it gets to be a little bit of a dilemma. It's unfair in some ways. Photographers would say that's unfair. That's not a real picture. You know, you didn't use the time and the field craft to take an accurate picture. What you did was you built it afterwards. It's the same thing that's happening in the music industry, you know, where we have hit records that no musician physically played on. It's all done by computers.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I mean, we never try to pass anything off in our magazine as, you know, something that's created digitally, unless it is. And sometimes we'll sandwich some birds together for effect, and mm-hmm. in which case we label it as an illustration as opposed to a photograph.
Mm-hmm. And
but it is a great philosophical question. It's one that's been argued for ever since computers came on the scene.
And you're speaking not only as a bird watcher, of course, but also as a musician.
That's right. Oh yeah, for sure. And you know, the musician's friend in the studio is MIDI, where you can make all kinds of sounds playing notes on a keyboard or a guitar. I can make my guitar sound like a cello. I can make my keyboard sound like a trumpet section. You know, I'd love to be able to hire a trumpet section, but that's not really in the cards for our little band.
Mike in Dublin, you're on the air with Bill Thompson. Welcome.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Ann.
Hi.
Hi.
I hope this never happens to anybody. And as an amateur photographer and wildlife and nature lover, I always got my camera with me. And I went to visit a friend of mine in Mexico last month and had my older Nikon D80 with me and a brand new SanDisk compact flash in it. Went out. We went and through Mazatlan, took about 20 or 30 pictures, and I got back to his condo and reviewed them. They look great. Then what happened was then we went out whale watching, and about midway through the trip, was back in the hotel room, reviewed the pictures. They look great. Came back to, took about 700 or 800 pictures on the whale and bird watching trip. Came back to Mazatlan before I returned to Columbus and reviewed the pictures. They look great. Went out into Mazatlan that afternoon and took about 20 pictures of just downtown sites, came back, and the only pictures that showed up on the card were the last 16 pictures I took in downtown Mazatlan. The other 700 or 800 pictures were mysteriously missing. Of course, I had a nervous breakdown.
I'm sorry to laugh, Mike.
No. You can laugh now because tactically it turned out okay. But at the time, it was like I'm crying, I'm screaming and yelling. It was like I'm 3 feet from a whale and its baby, and taking these incredible pictures, and now they're missing. So I call Nikon from Mexico and go through all the steps and things, and they say, well, it can't be the camera, must be the card. I said it was a brand new card. They said, well, rarely, but occasionally there's a defect or a flaw in the card. I said, well, okay. So I had to wait till I got home, and I called a friend of mine who does a website for me, and he said he's got connections. You can go online, and there's a focus group, and if they fix it, you pay them, and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I went to my local camera store, and I'm not going to mention them, but they were terrific. And a guy that works there I've known for years, he sent the card off and called me a week later and said they've recovered, they think, about 600 pictures. So I went in to see him, and they were all out of position. I mean, the beginning of the trip was at the end. The end of the trip was at the beginning. But who cares? They were all there. I mean, it was a miracle.
What happened?
The compact flash card, SanDisk, which they make, billions of these cards, was corrupted. And it was corrupted at birth. And it was brand new card. There's no explanation for exactly what was wrong with it. They can't explain exactly what happened. But it dumped. There's files within there, and it'll create other files. And it created files that couldn't be seen either in the viewer of the camera or on my computer. But when they sent it off to the people who are the geniuses with this, they opened and apparently went in and found files that weren't listed or were just missing, MIA.
Right.
And man, I have no clue. And you know what? I'll never understand it. But I'm so thankful.
Yikes.
So this is just a warning to people. Don't ever take anything for granted with these cards, because I would have. I've taken hundreds of thousands or a million pictures in my life.
Bill, has that ever happened to you?
Oh yeah, it's happened to me not only with images but with audio files, recording digital audio, and somewhere in the far flung corner of the world, and in desperation, bought a $99 program called Boomerang, which will go in and scan your cards for files that are hidden, files that are corrupted, files that have been... You can even get things that you've deleted off the card in some cases back, because they're still on there. It's just being told, it's just telling the device, whatever's reading the card, don't read this anymore.
Uh-huh.
It's now gone. So I've been able to recover many of my things. Sometimes if a card's bad, it's just bad and you can't get anything off it because it can't be read no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. I mean, backup, backup, backup. Some people even say one backup's not a backup, two backups is not a backup, three backups. And now you're talking backup.
Well, Bill and Mike, by the way, thank you so much for that call. Nice cautionary tale there. Bill Thompson, thanks for joining us today. I hope you have a great weekend.
And good luck to you, and thanks for everything. Great being with you.
Bill Thompson III is the editor and co-publisher of Birdwatchers Digest. He is also one of the chief organizers of the Birding Optics and Gear Expo, which will be at the Grange Insurance Audubon Center this weekend, March 23rd and 24th. For more information, we have a link at our website at wosu.org/all sides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, on the 10th anniversary of the start of the Iraq War, we talk with Aaron Glantz of the Center for Investigative Reporting. He arrived in Iraq just after Saddam Hussein fell, but for the past few years, he's been covering the lives of American veterans and investigating why many of them face lengthy delays in receiving disability benefits from the VA. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News. King George V and Queen Mary rescued the British monarchy from potential disaster. Thursday night, WOSU-TV tells the story of the king and queen who put duty first and faced dramatic social change following the First World War. Watch The Royals Who Rescued the Monarchy. It's Thursday night at 10 on WOSU-TV. And it's 30 degrees in downtown Columbus, some sunshine for today and a high of 38. Clear skies tonight, a low of 24 degrees. Some clouds on Wednesday with a high of 35. Support comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting dancer and choreographer Faye Driscoll's You're Me. The new critically acclaimed evening-length duet explores the complex nature of relationships. March 21st to the 23rd in the Wexner Center for the Arts. Details at wexarts.org. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We use our smartphones to check email, play games, take pictures, among other things. A growing trend is finding ways to use your smartphone as a personal wellness device to track your diet and monitor exercise routine. A new technology aims to take this a step further with a camera technology that can read your pulse. Joining us now to discuss this and other gadget news is Russell Holley. Russell is the tech writer for Geek.com, and he joins us nearly every Tech Tuesday. Welcome to the show, Russell.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So how can a camera read a pulse?
So this is actually something it's in development right now by Fujitsu, and they're using the camera to monitor your face. The camera watches your face for about 5 seconds, and the camera can read the flow of blood through the veins in your face and can use that to tell what your pulse is.
That's kind of creepy.
It's a little on the intense side. You're absolutely right. The idea is a little extreme, and when you consider, you know, how you as a person can look in a mirror and not see these things, you know, but this camera can look and make this distinction. So it's definitely interesting.
So it reads the flow. So that's all the camera does, is you just point it at your face and it takes your pulse.
Yeah, right now it's something where, you know, the camera has to be stationary and there has to be a pretty decent amount of light, but it can watch your face for the longest that it needs to watch your face in order to give you a reasonably accurate reading of your pulse is 5 seconds.
I thought you were going to say something like 5 minutes.
Yeah, this was really impressive stuff when I saw the demonstration that they were doing. It was, you know, they had this panel, you know, with what was basically a webcam that you could buy off the shelf, and some software. And the in the demonstration they gave, the guy walked up to the monitor, the camera watched him for, you know, just a moment, and then it gave his pulse and then continued to update as he stood there. And this technology there, you know, they've got it. It works reasonably well, and they're looking to move it into smartphones by the end of the year.
Okay, so it's the technology's there, but it's not out there yet.
Yeah, so basically Fujitsu has, you know, released their proof of concept, and they're looking to implement it into, you know, either an application or a dedicated piece of hardware for medical use, for personal use, just kind of all of the above. And the applications are really kind of interesting. You can imagine a situation where having a camera on a newborn, you know, constantly monitoring the blood flow of a newborn would be significantly less intrusive than, you know, connecting a child to a bunch of different monitors as the newborn lays there. And that kind of technology, you know, as it applies to the medical space, would also work really well for personal wellness if someone, you know, wanted to keep an eye on their pulse as they were in the gym, or if they, you know, came across someone who was in need of emergency services, they could collect that information and use it for the emergency responder. There's a lot of applications for this, and what's cool is that it requires so little training or know-how that it can be put in anything.
I'm just letting that absorb. I mean, are there other, what about something to take my temperature? I mean, is there any, I'm trying to figure out how the camera app translates to something like this. And when, say, they were developing these cameras, like say for an iPhone, were they aware? Are they way ahead of us and they're aware of what all these options are going forward?
Well, I mean, even current generation, like the iPhone, the current generation of the iPhone probably isn't high enough quality in the front camera to record this information, but the rear camera is definitely accurate enough. And there have been pulse monitoring applications for smartphones for a little while now. They just operate a little differently.
Uh-huh.
There's one where you place your finger over the camera and it actually illuminates the vessels with the LED flash. And so basically you hold it over the camera for a second and the light from the camera, you know, kind of makes everything glow around the finger, and it can measure the pulse that way. But this, you know, takes that quite a bit further.
And you say it's not out yet, but any estimates on when and cost? I mean, is this our usual $299 app or something a little more sophisticated?
They haven't said how exactly they plan to release it, only that they're working on, you know, having it available to the public within the year.
Okay. I mean, and ultimately, apps can't be too expensive, can they?
No, apps can't be too expensive, but I mean, we have apps in both Apple's App Store and Google's Play Store that, you know, go up as high as, you know, $15 or $20, depending on what's going on. And depending on what features, you know, if this is something that Fujitsu licensed to, you know, a 911 responder, you know, app, you know, that was released to the public by, you know, by the government, then, you know, you would expect that to be a free service, but you'd also expect it to work really well.
Mm-hmm.
Or if a hospital bought and licensed this technology and released it under private use, then there would be, you know, there would be an expectation there for how well it would work, and that would be where the expense would come from.
Gotcha. We're talking with Russell Halley, tech blogger for Geek.com. If you have a question for Russell on just about anything, I guess. I don't think you've only been stumped twice now. I don't know.
It happens every once in a while.
Yeah, every once in a while. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You wanted to talk about Facebook's Android update. You said there's a problem with the latest Facebook app update for Android phones. What's going on?
So it's not a problem. It's just something that users need to be aware of. There's
okay.
We talk a lot about viruses in smartphones every once in a while, and then, you know, what goes into that particular kind of application, you know, what it takes to get a virus on a smartphone. And on Android, it's a little easier in concept than it is on the iPhone, but only because there's a big button, you know, that makes it easy to do that. And the button is it's in every single Android phone, and it's the ability to install software from an unknown source. Basically, it's the ability to install software from somewhere other than Google, other than their App Store. And the new Facebook update for Android uses this feature to install updates to itself. Instead of releasing updates through Google's update system, they're building updates into the application. And that's really great because Facebook would be able to iterate much faster. They'd be able to push updates out as they saw fit. But it also kind of breaks some core functionality with how Android applications work. Especially the first time that you go to install an update, it's going to request that you check this box that says, you know, install software from unknown sources. And the big problem with that is that if you don't uncheck that box immediately afterward, then you're going to run into some problems later on if you accidentally click the wrong link or do anything that could, you know, have software installed without your knowing.
Okay, so to update that, to add that update, you have to have it checked at install from unknown sources, and immediately after you have to remove that. How do you immediately after remove that? Where do you go to just you just go back to the same place?
Yes, it's the exact same place in the settings menu. It's, you know, a lot of times for applications or privacy or sometimes even development options, the builds for Android, they move it around a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always the same button. It's always labeled the same. It's the ability to install from unknown sources.
Okay.
And it's a checkbox. You check it once if you want to be able to install things, and you uncheck it if you don't want things to be able to be installed. If you uncheck it, things that you've already installed are going to be fine.
Okay. That was my experience. Okay. All right. And you said they wanted to add this update to make things faster. That Facebook did it.
Was that it gave them the ability to push updates at will. They could push updates, kind of seamlessly and not have to really worry about, how long it would take for the Google Play Store to update, and they'd be able to make small updates without having to, make a grand update through the Play Store. But it, in a lot of cases, that kind of thing takes the same amount of time for most users.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not really sure, if there's just a step away from Google and trying to handle things on their own, or if they're going to try and do this through other software channels. But, for right now, it doesn't seem to be causing any real damage. But I don't think Facebook's doing a good enough job making people aware of the button they're asking them to push in order to install it.
But the key is, no matter what, that after you've installed it, go back to settings and put the check mark back in front of do not install for unknown sources.
Exactly. Yeah. You want to make sure that box is not checked.
Not checked. Okay, that's right. Not checked. We talked a little bit about this last week. Automatic?
Yeah, it's a really, we've talked a little bit about connected cars in the past, and automatic is a step that has been made further, and there's been a couple of developments with this particular tool. The idea was kind of interesting the more I thought about it, in that it's going to be available for both iPhone and Android, and it takes all the information from your car and all the information that you use on your phone for collecting data and where you've gone as far as GPS and things like that,
mm-hmm.
and it puts them together in a really useful way. It kind of turns your phone into a personal assistant for your car.
Well, for instance, what can you learn from monitoring your driving like that?
Well, the biggest thing that you can learn from monitoring your driving like that is how you're driving, how you accelerate, when the light turns green, or how quickly you brake, when the light turns red. And these kind of things are, it's information that is made available by the car, but the car itself doesn't ever really do anything with that information. So automatic takes that information and applies kind of location logic to it. So if you're on a road where there's a long stretch, and you've done it off of the green light, then the notification from your phone, that there'll be a slow pulse or something like that to let you know that there's a better way to do that.
Hmm.
There's a better way to drive in that instance. And as you continue to follow the instructions that are given by the car by the application, it will actually demonstrate to you how better driving can affect your mileage and vehicle maintenance.
That's right. This is the same thing that's hooked up with the stuff that the diagnostics in your car, right?
Exactly.
All right. And how exactly will it work? I mean, you'll have an app on your phone.
So you'll have an app on your phone, and you'll have a Bluetooth connector that gets plugged into the diagnostic port in your car.
Okay.
Every car has a diagnostic port, and if you've had a car within the last 5 years, then that car spits out a lot of information through that diagnostic port that the car itself doesn't really use for much. But the automatic app will take that information and apply it to the metrics that you know this company has on what it thinks is the best way to drive your car to get the best mileage and the best, you know, long-term maintenance.
I think this is really interesting, particularly for someone who has somebody who's a new driver.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's great as an educational tool, especially since, you know, it takes things like the price of gas and, you know, the price of your last oil change and things like that, and it takes that information over time, and the longer you use the application, the more it will show you, you know, the you made, you know, your driving over the last week. You know, we made 19 suggestions to you, and you followed 7 of them. These are the improvements in mileage that you saw by doing what we told you to do.
And it has some emergency features?
It has some location features that can be used for either emergency or looking for your car and whatnot. Because it is connected to your car, when the car stops, when you turn the engine off, automatic grabs your location and uses that as a resting point for where your car is. So if you're leaving a mall, you can use it to tell where your car is. If you share your vehicle with other people, you know, if you share with new drivers or just with other drivers, mm-hmm. you can actually get information and share it safely, share it securely through the app to another person that you have set up as a driver on that profile. Or, you know, if you're in an accident, if the information from the vehicle leaves automatic to believe that you're in an accident, it will reach out to emergency responders and to whoever you've set up as emergency contact with a text message or, you know, an emergency phone call in the case of 911 or something like that, and let them know what has happened.
You know, I'm kind of loving this. On the other hand, I'm thinking, wow, that means that, I mean, eventually it creates some evidence.
It's definitely.
I knew you would get what I was talking about.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of that, it's really who has access to that information. I mean, mm-hmm. if you're in a situation where you know you're constantly running a red light, and automatic is aware that you're constantly running the red light, then you know it's pretty aware of that kind of thing. But at the same time, you know, if it can make you a better driver, or at the very least make you more aware of what you're doing, and that can be pretty significant as well.
Well, I'm definitely an altruist like you, but it's not out yet.
It's not out yet. They're mm-hmm. looking to have it out for the iPhone this summer, and it'll be a little closer to the fall, maybe even Christmas time, before it's out for Android, mainly because it's a Bluetooth connection, and for iPhones, you know, kind of Bluetooth is always the same across all of those things, but for Android, Bluetooth works a little tiny bit differently on each manufacturer, so they've got to do a little more work there.
And they want it all coming out at the same time?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They want it to work. They want it to, at the very least, pretend to work the same on everything.
And how much does it cost? Do we know?
They haven't really said. I mean, it's going to be two different parts. The application is probably going to be free, but the Bluetooth port that you're going to be plugging into your car is about $60.
Okay.
And that is a little more expensive than if you had like a do-it-yourself solution. Like if you had just a Bluetooth ODB connector, those are usually about $20 or $30.
Mm-hmm.
So they're definitely making a little bit of money there. But it doesn't seem like they're going to be charging for the application itself. So maybe they'll have a setup where you can kind of bring your own Bluetooth connection to the car. But chances are they're going to have, you know, kind of they're going to want you to use their thing.
All right. Well, Russell Holly, thanks a lot for talking with us today. That's interesting. And down the road, no pun intended, maybe we can check it out and try it out and see what we think.
Absolutely. Thanks All for right. having me again.
Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks to the AllSides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producers Corinne Gleckler and Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karim Shaban and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks to my boss, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, for filling in for me yesterday. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Also, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is 89.7. And WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.